Chapter 5. Before he was released to return to active duty, Steele saw Oliver Higgins once again. It was in that same conference room where they had met the first time, only this time it was just the two of them alone. "Come in, Steele," said Higgins. He was standing by the bar. "Have a drink?"
"Thanks."
"Scotch rocks, right?"
"Yeah,"
said Steele, no longer surprised by what they knew. Higgins poured two scotches. He took his neat. He handed Steele his drink and they sat down.
"I just wanted to have a few words with you before you left," Higgins said. "I thought about giving you some version of the standard little speech telling you how well you've done and thanking you for the service that you've provided for your country, but I don't think you really want to hear it."
Steele smiled slightly. We've arranged with the police department for you to come in once a week for a while, each Monday for a few follow-up sessions, and to maintain a periodic check-in on the implant to make sure it continues to function properly. We don't anticipate any problems, but we'd just like to be sure. We maintain a check on all our test subjects from time to time.
"How many have you got?" asked Steele.
"That's classified information," Higgins said, "which brings me to the main point of our discussion."
"I keep my mouth shut," Steele said.
"That's right," said Higgins. "Everything that's happened here stays behind these doors. You're not to discuss any aspect of this project or your involvement in it with anyone. If anyone asks you where you were, what you were doing, if you must say anything, simply say that you were on detached duty to the government and you're not at liberty to speak about it. Period. I hope that's clear."
"It's clear," said Steele.
"Good. I see your hair started to grow back in again. The scar is small enough, and it should not be noticeable. But just in case, if anyone remarks on it, just tell them you were wounded and had to take a few sutures. I'm sure you can improvise something appropriate. Just don't go into too many details."
"I'll manage."
"About your wife," said Higgins. The corner of Steele's mouth twitched and his jaw muscles tightened. "Just to set the record straight, it was I who had her placed under surveillance. You were involved in a highly classified government project, and as such, I needed to know about you and your personal environment. Now, I'm not going to try to tell you what to do about your personal life. That's your business. But your wife has clearly demonstrated that she's not a woman to be trusted. I frankly don't care what you tell her, but she's a security risk, and she's not to know anything about what you've been doing the past couple of weeks. If you don't want to know who she's been seeing, that's entirely up to you. But if you should change your mind or find yourself needing to take any legal steps concerning your domestic situation, we can supply you with full documentation of her activities as well as photographs."
"You had my room wired,"
said Steele, realizing that the only way Higgins could have known about his reluctance to hear the details of his wife's affairs was if he had the room bugged or if Susan Carmody had told him about what happened. He couldn't imagine her doing that.
"Yes, and there was a concealed surveillance camera as well. Dr. Carmody didn't know about that, of course, and to save her embarrassment, I think she'd be better off not knowing."
"Hope you enjoyed the show," Steele said dryly.
"I don't go in for that sort of thing," said Higgins. "He will eventually, but let's not get into that. Besides, there wasn't all that much to see. Frankly, you could do a lot worse, and I think you have. But that's your business."
Steele grimaced.
"You're some piece of work, Higgins."
"I see you haven't taken advantage of our offer to supply you with any educational programming," Higgins said, changing the subject.
"May I ask why?"
"I'm pretty much satisfied with the way things are," said Steele.
"Well, if you should change your mind, the offer still stands. The implant is permanent. When we're finished with you, you can simply choose to forget it, or you can come in at any time and request educational programming. It would help us in our evaluation, and you never know, in your line of work, you could easily be injured. It wouldn't hurt to have something to fall back on."
"Thanks. I'll keep it in mind,"
Steele grimaced.
"No pun intended."
Higgins smiled mirthlessly. "All right, Lieutenant," he said. "We probably won't be seeing each other again. I gather you don't mind that very much. In any case, I'd like to thank you for your participation in the project and wish you luck." He stood and offered Steele his hand. Steele looked down at it for a moment, then took it. They shook and turned to leave.
Oh, one more thing, Higgins said.
Steele paused. Higgins handed him a card. just in case, if you ever find yourself in need of some official clout or some unofficial help for whatever reason, call that number. Give whoever answers the number stapled on your stamped on your project ID, then ask for me and I'll see what I can do. If you don't give them that number, they'll say they never heard of me. Steele took the card. Thanks! Don't mention it. Goodbye, Lieutenant. Steele nodded and left. A security contingent was waiting to escort him back up to the lobby, where he was given back his weapons, including his boot knife and his watch. He went out through the gate and simply stood there on the street for a few minutes, enjoying the feeling of being outside for the first time in 2 weeks, and wondering what to do. He wasn't ready to report back in yet, and he couldn't stand the thought of going home. He wasn't up to facing Janice. He needed time to think. He wished he didn't know what he knew now. Yeah, he took a deep breath and started walking towards St. Vincent's. Mick Taylor drove the armored strike force unit up Fifth Avenue, heading towards Harlem. Steele sat beside him, preoccupied. Except for buses, cabs, and the occasional supply trucks that had to be escorted into Midtown by police convoys, there was no traffic in the city. The days of gridlock were long over. Only the wealthiest citizens owned private vehicles anymore. And only several of the subway lines still ran beneath the streets of Midtown. And only several? All right. As a result, most people took cabs and buses to get around the city. During the daylight hours, there was a good deal of pedestrian and bicycle traffic. But after dark, the streets became practically deserted. New York, once a city that never slept, now locked its steel shutters as soon as it grew dark, and the night creatures came out to prowl the urban jungle. The night belonged to the police and those they hunted. "You're being awful quiet lately," Mick said as he drove. Steele glanced at him and shrugged. "Got things on my mind," he said. Mick hesitated. "Shelley's been talking to Janice," he said. "She says you haven't been home in a while." "I was on detached duty for the feds," said Steele. "Yeah, but you've been back for 3 days now, and Shelley says you still haven't been home." He paused briefly. "You want to talk about it?" Steele said nothing for a moment. "Janice has been cheating on me," he said finally. Mick sighed. "Damn. You're sure?" "I'm sure." "Jesus, that's a bitch. You know who the guy is?" Steele shook his head. "I don't want to know," he said. "Besides, it seems like there's more than one." "Oh, hell, I'm sorry," Mick said. "Does she know you know about it?" Steele shook his head. "What are you going to do?" "I don't know," said Steele. "You're going to talk to her?" "I don't know what to say." "You can't just not say anything," said Mick. "You have to confront her with it." "That's what Father Casey says," said Steele. "But I don't know what would be worse, if she denied it or admitted it."
"If she denies it, you've got proof?"
"Oh, yeah," said Steele wryly. "Fully documented, complete with photographs."
"You had her followed."
"I'd rather not go into it," said Steele. "The proof is there. I haven't seen it, but it's there. I don't really want to see it."
"You going to ask her for a divorce?"
"No," said Steele. "But if she wants one, she can have it," he snorted. "The hell of it is, I still love her, Mick."
"Yeah, that's the hell of it, all right."
"I mean, maybe it was my fault somehow. Maybe I just couldn't give her what she wanted."
"Well, maybe," Mick said, "but if it were me, partner, I wouldn't blame myself. Janice is a funny sort of gal. I mean, I don't want to get out of line here, but the fact is, I never could really figure out what you two had together. Janice and I never got along too well. She doesn't like cops one bit. She seemed to like you well enough, though. Well, enough to marry you and have two kids with you.
Geez, how long has it been? Almost 20 years? "About that.
You never did talk much about your home life, about your kids, yeah, but never much about Janice.
We've had our ups and downs."
"Well, this is a definite down," said Mick.
"Don't say anything to Shelley."
"Hey, come on." Steele grimaced.
"Sorry, it's just that I'm not sure how to deal with this. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Close my eyes and look the other way for the kids' sake?"
I couldn't, Mick said.
"No, I don't think I can either," Steele said.
"You've got to face her sometime."
"Yeah, I know. Trouble is, I don't know how." He sat silent for a moment. "It's just that I'm pretty sure I know exactly how it's going to go," he said. "She'll start off denying it. We'll fight. And she'll admit it. Throw it up into my face and try to put it off on me. She'll say she was driven to it because I wasn't there for her. And after we've had it out, she'll try to make up and promise that she'll never do it again. That things will be better from now on. But I don't believe they will be. I've heard all that before. I'll never be able to trust her again, Mick. Who knows how long this has been going on?"
"How can you live with her like that?" Steele shook his head.
"I just don't know," he said. "But I know I can't walk out. The whole thing's got me feeling sort of numb, I guess. I know I should do something, but I can't think straight. If we split up, how the hell do I tell the kids?"
"If it comes to that, you'll just have to tell them," Mick said. "Otherwise, they'll only wind up hearing her version of it.
They're not really children anymore, you know. They're teenagers. They can stand to hear the truth. Yeah, but how can I stand to tell it to them? You can't whip out on this one, buddy. You've got to deal with it somehow. I know. I've had to deal with a lot of things lately. That job for the feds was tough, huh? I really can't talk about it, Mick. It's classified. But after what happened there, I don't know if things will ever be the same again. And now this thing with Janice on top of it all.
You gonna be all right with this one, partner? Mick said. I need to know before we get there, because this thing could get rough.
I'm all right, said Steele.
You sure?
If you've got doubts about me, Mick, then say so. I'll bring the backup and get another partner out for this. I don't want you to be worried about me. This could be an ambush.
Yeah, it could be, Mick agreed. It's not like the Skulls went a parlay. The whole thing reads like a setup.
Yeah, that's why Hardass picked to send me in.
Mick glanced at him. What is it with you and Hardesty, anyway?
I hold up a mirror to him, Steele said, and he doesn't like what he sees.
Mick frowned. How do you mean?
Steele sighed. Jake and I go back a lot of years, he said. He was my training partner, and then, for a while, he was my partner. Then he was my sergeant. When I made sergeant, he was my lieutenant. And for my money, Jake Hardesty was the best damn cop who ever hit the streets. He taught me everything I know.
So what happened?
He got promoted to a desk and stopped being a street cop, and that changed him. Jake used to be a real hard charger. Always was. He was always bucking the brass.
Just like you, huh? Mick said with a grin.
Yeah, a lot like me, I guess. Maybe that's why I get on his nerves so much. He was always fighting with the brass. Always figured he knew better. Most of the time, he did. He figured that if he made captain, he could change things. But instead, he was the one who changed.
How so?
I don't know. Maybe he just got tired. Maybe he found out being captain meant having to make executive decisions he didn't want to make. He found himself caught in the middle between the administration and the men under his command, and he couldn't really be a part of either. Suddenly, he was the brass, and I was like the old Jake Hardesty, fighting him at every turn each time he started playing bureaucrat. I'm one of the few people who remembers what the old Jake Hardesty was like, and the new one doesn't like to be reminded of it. Makes him feel guilty. I guess it makes him feel old.
Maybe you should try just backing off a bit, said Mick. Stop pushing him so hard.
The chief and everyone above him pushes Jake, said Steele. Somebody's got to push back. Jake doesn't have much stomach for it anymore.
They reached 125th Street and turned left, cruising slowly over towards Lenox. They were out of Midtown now and deep in no man's land. The difference was dramatic. The area was much more run down here, with many buildings standing empty, some boarded up, some with glassless windows and storefronts gaping out onto the street. The streets were in much worse condition down here. None of the repair crews ever ventured out of Midtown. Maybe you should check with backup, Mick said. Steele reached for the radio, which had a built-in scrambler circuit so that no one could tune in to their band and eavesdrop.
Unit 4 to backup units, he said.
Unit 10 here, came back the reply. What's going on, Steele?
We're approaching the rendezvous point at 125th and Lenox, Steele said. What's your location, McCaulkey?
We're about 6 blocks behind you.
Okay, McCaulkey, hold it there, said Steele. I'll maintain radio contact when I go in. Be ready to move in case I need you.
Roger.
Steele out.
He replaced the handset on the hook. You really think ICE is going to be there? Mick said.
Your guess is as good as mine, said Steele.
I don't like the thought of you going in alone.
I'm not exactly thrilled about it either, Steele said. But that's not what the man said he wanted. A parlay with a senior strike force cop, one-on-one.
You ever seen ICE before? Said Mick. Steele shook his head.
No. As far as I know, no one has who lived to tell about it. He's been leading the Skulls for as long as I've been around. That's a long time to hold the number one spot in a street gang. He's got to be a tough SOB.
You better watch your back, partner, Mick said.
That's what I'm counting on you for, Mick, said Steele. Okay, looks like this is it.
He picked up the handset.
Unit 4 to backup, he said.
McCulkey here. Go ahead, Steele.
Okay, I'm going in. Stand by.
You got it. Be careful, buddy.
Will do, said Steele. Keep your ears on.
He replaced the handset, tightened up the straps on his flak vest, and put it on his riot helmet. He quickly checked all his weapons, making sure they were loaded and the safeties were off.
Anybody goes in there after me, I want to know about it, he said.
Anybody goes in there after you is going to have to go through me first, said Mick. Take care of yourself, partner.
Right.
He picked up his battle rifle and stepped out of the armored unit. He heard the high-pitched whine of the servo motors as Mick trained the unit's guns on the entrance to the storefront. He looked around. The streets were empty. They usually empty pretty fast the moment word got around the strike force unit was cruising the vicinity, but he felt as if there were 100 pairs of eyes watching his every move. He crossed the street, heading towards the abandoned storefront.
The glass in the front window had long since been broken and the door torn off its hinges. Painfully aware that he would make an easy target, Steele lowered the visor on his riot helmet and stepped in through the door. His boots crunched on bits of concrete and broken glass as he entered the dark store and switched on the starlight lens built into the visor. Whatever had once been sold in the store, there was no trace of it now. There was nothing but rubble and debris. The fixtures had long since been torn down and out of the ceiling, and much of the ceiling itself was gone. There were gaping holes in the flame-blackened walls, and gang graffiti was everywhere. He stepped over the remains of a campfire that had been built right there on the floor, pieces of charred wood scattered all around it. There were several burned and torn-up mattresses thrown here and there, and towards the back, almost the entire wall had collapsed, with supporting beams falling down at angles to the floor.
"Hold it right there,"
a deep, unmistakably black voice called out. Steele looked around. Even with the starlight lens, he couldn't see any sign of him. He stopped.
"Where's your backup?"
said the voice. "Outside in the unit," Steele said.
"I don't mean your partner, Turkey. I mean your backup."
"There's just the two of us," said Steele.
"Don't rattle my chain, policeman."
The voice was ominous.
"I ain't so stupid."
"They're about 6 blocks away, standing by," said Steele.
"Right answer,"
said the voice.
"How many units?"
8, said Steele.
"Right again, policeman. You in radio contact?"
"Yeah."
"Fine. They so much as move an inch, I'm out of here."
"Why don't you come out where I can see you?"
"Why don't you take off the body armor, put the pieces down, and come back here?"
"Why don't you go fuck yourself?" You heard a deep chuckle.
"Okay, policeman. You stand right there and keep the hands where I can see them. We'll talk."
"So talk."
"I got me a problem,"
I said.
"Name of Victor Borodini."
"I thought you two were doing business," Steele said.
"Business one thing, taking orders from that slick another. I don't take orders from nobody. I especially don't take orders from no white man."
"If you do business with Victor Borodini, you do," said Steele.
"Not my idea to do business with that slick,"
Ice snapped. "That so? Trouble in the ranks, Ice?" said Steele. "You loosen your grip?"
"Not your business, policeman. You want Borodini, I can give him to you on a platter. You interested?"
"What makes you think you can deliver Borodini?"
"You want him or not?"
"Yeah, I want him. What's the deal?"
"Borodini call a council. Leaders of the Skulls, the Chingos, and the Dragons. Take place tomorrow night. The man himself be there. I can tell you where and when."
"And what do you want in return?"
"Nothing. You just take him down."
"And what about your people?"
"Breaks the game."
"I see," said Steele. "You've been displaced as leader of the Skulls, and you're giving us Borodini so we can nail him and take out your competition at the same time. Is that it?"
"You ain't so stupid either,"
I said.
"What's your name, policeman?"
"Steele."
"Steele. I remember that. You're gonna owe me, Steele."
"I don't owe you a thing, Ice. We'll be doing you a favor. You're the one that's gonna owe me." Ice gave a short, barking laugh.
"Okay, policeman. You have it your way. You come down to Harlem and collect any time."
"Where's the meeting gonna be?" Suddenly, there was a concussive whump of an explosion outside, and Steele winced as a sharp scream rang out over his helmet speakers. He spun around. Across the street, the armored police unit was in flames, black smoke pouring from it. As he watched, Mick came stumbling out of it, on fire. There was a second explosion, and the entire unit disintegrated in a blaze of fire, smoke, and shrapnel. The blast picked Mick up and hurled him about 15 yards. "Mick!" Steele shouted. "All units! Officer down! McCulkey!" The entire storefront exploded, and Steele was hurled back by the concussion and the wash of flame. His unit caught fire. Part of the ceiling fell down in on him. Beating at the flames, he struggled up from the debris and fired the rifle on full auto as he staggered toward the burning front of the abandoned store. He couldn't see anything for all the smoke and flame. Coughing, he raised his visor as he staggered through the gaping fissure where the front of the store had been. Large caliber automatic weapons opened up on him. He felt bullets rip into his arms and legs, pulverizing bone, and he felt the rapid sledgehammer impacts on his flak vest as the immediately powerful slugs tore through it, throwing him back through the flaming storefront window. Flames licked at him as he tried to crawl back farther into the ruined store. He could smell his own flesh burning. He could hear the sirens of the backup units rapidly approaching. Then he heard the telltale clunk of a grenade launcher, and he scrambled back madly through the flame and smoke as the explosion shook the building. The ceiling caved in on him as a large support beam fell, pinning him to the floor. Plaster, lathe, and concrete rained down upon him. He was trapped. He couldn't move. "McCulkey!" He screamed into his helmet mic. Not knowing it was broken, most of his helmet shot away. "McCulkey!" He screamed in agony, his arms pinned down, unable to beat at his flaming clothes. Another explosion ripped into the building, and more debris rained down upon him, burying him completely from the waist up. He fought for air, but inhaled only concrete and plaster dust. There was nothing he could do. The odds had run out on him at last. He could no longer feel the pain of his wounds, could only feel the burning in his chest and his lungs. lungs, screamed for air in his crushed rib cage. As the blackness encroached, he struggled against it, but it dragged him down inexorably, closing down on him like a dark pool and sucking him down into oblivion. End of chapter 5.